So welcome along to the Loose Goose once again. And really, it's a delight again to find another really interesting and very topical topic for the... I have a topical topic for the programme. Joined today by Dr. Paul Carr from the University of South Wales. Hello, Paul.
Good to meet you, Steve, again.
And thanks for doing this. You've very handily given me a bit of information so I can try and remember this, but this is Frank Zappa and the And, which is a book which is being released this week by Ashgate Poplar and Folk Music Series. You've got a whole bunch of contributors here from all around the world, essentially talking about issues surrounding Frank Zappa and what he's all about, really. So tell us all about him. What's his fascination with Zappa? What's that about?
Well, it goes back a long time. Just to say that the book is actually already out, but the launch is this week.
Okay.
The book's already available.
And there's a special offer currently?
There's a special...
Not why we're doing the show, of course.
No, not at all, but there is a special offer because of the book launch, where the book has been offered for half price up until the end of November. We've got a couple of book launches coming up, one in Cardiff at the end of this week, and there's also a launch going on up in Nottingham in November at Nottingham Contemporary.
Okay, and if people wanted to get a copy of the book, is it just available in general bookstores, or did they go to the ashgate.com website, perhaps?
It's available on the net widely through Amazon. You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it directly from Ashgate. Or if you're interested in being involved in the launch and you want to get the 50% offer, you could just email me direct, and I'll provide the various pieces of information.
Okay, Frank Zappa and the And, with the And on the end there in a capital letter. So what's that title all about?
It's a contextual book. I've been writing on Zappa for a long time now, about 7 years. I've written a number of articles on him, which have been published. And a couple of years ago, I came up with the idea. It seemed to me that Zappa, his music has got so many different contexts. I'd already written about a number of different themes with Zappa, and it seemed that it was the right time to try and encourage other authors to try and engage with this idea of relating Zappa to a part of popular culture. So, for example, in Zappa and in the And, you'll see Zappa juxtapositioned against things like technology, against musical theatre, and so on and so forth, a whole range of different subject matters with authors actually from all over the world, America, New Zealand, obviously the UK, Denmark, literally all over. So it was an opportunity to encourage authors to think, how can you consider Zappa's portfolio against something that interests you and write 7,000 or 8,000 words about it? And that's essentially what the book's about. It's sort of, if you want to be clever about it, it's an exercise in semiology.
Okay, we're going to go to a song now, and we just talked about the order in which we were going to play the songs, and you said, well, Frank Zappa didn't really believe in order, so we'll just check them on as they come along. The first one happens to be Plastic People.
Yeah, one of Zappa's real famous maxims is anything, anytime, for no reason at all. And his sort of philosophical belief was that time wasn't chronological, but that it all happens at the same time. And yeah, it doesn't matter what order we play the tracks in. Just like in Zappa and the And, I made a point of the chapters not being chronological. They're in a random order.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Fellow Americans.
He's been sick. And I think his wife is going to bring him some chicken soup.
Plastic people. Oh, baby, now you're such a drag.
I know it's hard to defend an unpopular policy every once in a while.
Plastic people, oh baby, now you're such a drag.
And there's this guy from the CIA, and he's creeping around Laurel Canyon.
Fine little girl, she waits for me. She's as plastic as she can be. She paints her face with plastic goo.
food. Plastic people.
Sometimes I just get tired of you, honey. It's your hairspray or something.
Plastic people! Oh, baby, you're such a drag!
I hear the sound of marching feet down Sunset Boulevard to Crescent Heights, and there at Pandora's Box, we are confronted with a vast quantity of plastic people.
Take a day and walk around. Watch the Nazis run your town. Then go home and check yourself. You think we're singing about someone else,
but you're plastic people. Oh, baby, now you're such a drag.
There you go, Frank Zappa with Plastic People, and it's the Loose Goose, and we're joined by Dr. Paul Carr, talking about, particularly about the book Frank Zappa and the And. And you were saying there, Paul, about the fact that the songs that you've chosen for the show kind of illustrate different facets which crop up within the book.
Yeah.
So where are we going with that one?
Well, that was a real early recording of Zappa's from the 60s. And even at that stage, there's a few things that are quite interesting which he was to pursue over the years. The first being, I really believe that Zappa was he hasn't received the credit he deserves for the way that he incorporated the recording studio as a creative tool.
Can you give me an example of that?
Well, using the recording studio to manipulate time and space, for example, where he deliberately did that. It was very much influenced by Musique Concrète, Peter Schaeffer, people like that, and the whole idea of having a segment of music which is juxtapositioned against something else which is totally unrelated, so you get this clash. And in that particular piece that we've just heard there, although it's one single piece of music, when you analyze it in depth, you can tell it's made up of multiple takes. And Zappa was a real master at doing this. Sometimes it's a lot more obvious than what had appeared on that track. I would say also in that piece of music, he loved satire, Zappa. In fact, that was one of the main ingredients of his idiolect that got me involved in his music as a young 13-year-old. I just thought he was funny. And you know, he's constantly passing political commentary on the time that he was observing it. And that particular piece is looking at the hippie movement, which he absolutely despised, and he's entitling these people plastic people. So yeah, there's so much in each of these tracks. I could probably spend the whole program just talking about that. But
what was his problem with hippies?
Insincere and not real. Plastic. I think I read somewhere with Zappa where a typical hippie could perhaps be a bank manager during the week, but he would be a hippie of a weekend. So he believed that it was a sort of a false state of being.
Okay. I mean, do you think with Zappa, you know, obviously we're looking back on Zappa now, but was he recognised enough, if you like, at a sort of peak, or is it only retrospectively that this fascination with Zappa has kind of emerged?
Yeah, with my own story, if you like, is I got into Zappa, as I said before, as a 13, 14 year old in the sort of mid 70s. And I very much got into him because A, I thought he was funny, like I've said, but B, he was just a great guitar player.
He is great.
I loved his guitar playing. Ironically, there's nothing about his guitar playing in Zappa in the end. That's something else we could write about.
Yes.
He's so interesting. There's nothing about his guitar playing. That tells you how interesting some of these other facets are. But yeah, he was on the periphery of my consciousness. I was too young to get Zappa in the 60s, obviously. I don't remember him then. But he did come onto my consciousness in the mid-70s and then into the early 80s. Then it disappeared for a while. And it's only really 6 or 7 years ago I started to look back at Zappa. And as a mature man and someone who, you know, obviously trained as a musicologist and so on and so forth, I could then see so much more depth in his music than what I could as a young guy. And originally just intended to write a couple of papers really with my colleague Richard Hand, but I just couldn't stop. In fact, now I'm having to make a conscious decision. I need to stop writing about Zappa now. So, you know, I'm moving on to other things.
I've got a name for your next book.
Yeah.
Frank Zappa and the Butt. What do you reckon?
I like it. Yeah, it sounds good.
Work. He used to cut the grass. Do you want to say anything about this? This is a long, long track. We'll play a bit of this, yeah?
Yeah, let's play it and then we'll talk after it.
I'm out at last. Boy, the world sure looks different. Wow, there's hardly anything fun to do since they made music illegal. But I'm hooked. I got to have it. I've got to have it. I need to play. But there's no musicians anymore. They're all gone. Wait, I've got it. I'll be sullen and withdrawn. I'll dwindle off into the twilight realm of my own secret thoughts. I'll walk through the parking lot in a semi-catatonic state and dream of guitar notes to go with the loading zone announcement. Thank you.
There's Frank Zappa doing his guitar bit. I was just saying to Paul on a previous Loose Goose a while back, there was a great guitarist, and Frank Zappa was very much in there. Magnificent musician, Paul, and not really always recognised for that, I don't think.
Very much underestimated. It was one of the reasons behind the book. I really didn't think that Zappa, over the years, has got the credit he deserves as a musician. He's an incredible musician. That was an example of his guitar playing from an album called Joe's Garage. And going back to what I was saying earlier on regarding his use of the recording studio, Zappa very much preferred his his guitar playing when he was playing live at a concert in front of 10,000 people. So he developed this self-titled philosophy called Xenochrony, where it's taken from the Greek meaning alien time. It means alien time. And what he would do is record all of his guitar solos when he was on tour, and then he would go in the recording studio, lay down some studio tracks, but then import his guitar solos from live performance into the recording studio. And when I first heard this technique, as a young guitar player, I would be listening to Zappa and thinking some really unusual choices of notes over those particular chords. I could never quite understand that sort of angular sound that he got as a guitar player. And of course, I found out later that that was the reason why, because the track that he was playing over live wasn't the same track as what the guitar solo was imported into. So Joe's Garage, the album, is probably one of the most famous exponents of Xenochrony. I think all of the tracks, and it's a double album, apart from Watermelon and Easter Hay, one of the final track on the album, they're all imported in the way that I'm describing. And I think, you know, I was saying to you off air before, I think Zappa wasn't a man to bear his soul on record. He tended to use other people, or used a philosophy which I call strategic anti-essentialism, where it's a bit of a mouthful, but he basically pretended to be somebody else, and then he used that character to portray parts of his character that he wouldn't be able to portray normally, if that makes sense. But his guitar playing has a side that you just don't see anywhere else, and there's something really beautiful about it.
I don't suppose there is any link in this, but we with Peter Yakimiak recently, we did a popular show about David Bowie, and it kind of strikes me there are some sort of linkages in the way that they adopted personas to get messages across without being themselves.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. In Zappa's case, his name is his real name. You know, he was born Frank Zappa, but it's very, very difficult to pinpoint precisely who he is. You know, it's always difficult. Is the music high art or is it low art? Is he being serious or is he being frivolous? It's questions like that. It's very, very difficult to understand Zappa. And I think that's what makes his music so interesting when you listen to it on a in depth, as opposed to what I did as a child, where it was, you know, just quite a superficial level, really.
What's the kind of interest in Zappa these days, would you say? I mean, obviously the Loose Goose will get out there, it will go where it goes, when the book's out there on sale. Is there a big fascination, is there a sort of big sort of fan base still for Zappa these days?
Well, his son, Dweezil, is touring his music with the band Zappa Plays Zappa. He was playing, in fact, they played in Cardiff last year, and were in Bristol quite recently. I would say there's more interest in his music in Europe. For example, when I was doing some research for the book a few years ago, I went across to a festival called the Zappanali Festival in Bad Doberan in Germany. And this festival's incredible. It's 4 or 5 days of tribute bands, all who play Zappa's music. And the place is also littered with alumni. So all of Zappa's ex-sidemen play there. If not every year, they come periodically and either bring bands that they've put together or play with local musicians to play Zappa's music. And it's quite interesting. You go to somewhere like Berlin, for example. The last time I was in Berlin, I picked up a copy of Zappa's movie 200 Motels in the airport. It was actually in Berlin airport, mainstream shopping, where here you've got to dig pretty deep. Most record shops. I was in HMV, oddly enough, the other day with my son in Cardiff, and I seen there Frank, there was a Frank Zappa section. I thought, great, there was no records in it, no CDs in it. It was empty. So I it's a struggle to keep him in the public consciousness, I think, but it is there.
Well, hopefully the book is a step in the right direction. I'll come back to you in a second. I want to ask you a couple of things about some of the writers and contributors, because to me, it's not my territory, so they're kind of names. So maybe you can fill in a few gaps there.
Yeah, sure.
And I also want to ask you a little bit about musicology, because my wife asked me to ask you a question. So
no worries.
Let's go with G-Spot Tornado. I wonder what this one's about.
I don't know.
There's Frank Zappa, and you're listening to The Loose Goose. I mean, if I heard that, I wouldn't listen, actually, because it wouldn't pull me in, because I find it really quite a difficult listen. It's like a bordering up, well, it probably is, actually, an exemplar of what you could describe as technically proficient Muzak. But there's a point to all of that, isn't there?
Well, with Zappa, like I said at the start of the show, you know, this idea of anything, anytime, for no reason at all. With Zappa, he was a technically proficient, an incredibly technically proficient composer. And he liked the idea of pushing the boundaries of what was possible. And that's an example of that. It was recorded at a time where he was becoming quite frustrated with musicians, with their personal problems, and more importantly with the mistakes they made. He'd, a couple of years before, he'd recorded with the London Symphony Orchestra an album called the London Symphony Orchestra, Volume 1. But in his autobiography, he was really critical of the mistakes that these people made. His music is so complex that it required a lot of rehearsal.
And they were obviously top-notch musicians even then.
Yeah, but the music is so complicated, it requires a lot of rehearsal. And of course, that means money. Quite often, you know, that doesn't happen in the orchestral world.
No.
So he was fortunate enough to be able to work with this piece of technology called the Synclavier, where it was just him and a programmer, and the programmer punched in the notes exactly as he wanted them. And that's an example of that. It was played later by sort of real musicians, if you like. But, you know, he enjoyed using the Synclavier to negate what he called the human element, i.e., human mistakes. He didn't want mistakes in his music.
You mentioned it earlier. Could you just explain what musique concrète is?
Yeah, musique concrète.
Does that refer back to that at all in that way?
That particular piece doesn't really refer to it, but it's all the way through Zappa's music, ranging, you know, from Freak Out, the first album, all the way through to the last one, Civilization Phase 3. Mm. Musique concrète is there. And
what's the philosophy of it?
The idea is it deals with found sound. So I could go out with a tape recorder.
Okay.
And I could record you interviewing. I could record bits of this interview. I could interview somebody in the street. I could interview the sound of a church bell. And then I could go into a recording studio and juxtaposition those against each other. And, you know, it's the contrast of the environmental sounds next to each other, which forms the interest of the music. It really sort of breaks down a lot of barriers, or it certainly did at the time. In the 50s, when it first came about.
Now you're essentially a musicologist.
Mm-hmm.
My wife said, "Ask him what a musicologist is."
Oh, it means lots of different things to different people. I mean, I started off as I would have just described myself as a musician, really. And I then...
What kind of stuff do you play, or is it a wide range of stuff?
Yeah, I worked as a freelance guitar player. And
sessions?
Some sessions and, you know, some West End shows and just working guitar player. And I also played jazz. I made a living. I played in a band called the James Taylor Quartet, who I think Peter probably spoke about in previous shows.
I'm sure he did.
Recorded with them and toured with them and and all of that. And then I made the journey towards being a musicologist, I suppose. I did my PhD with Gavin Bryars, the composer. Gavin's one of the pioneering sort of British UK composers. And from there, I become more and more interested in how meaning in music is transferred across to people.
Okay.
And that's my interpretation of musicology. That's Zappa and the And is related to that. How does his music relate to non-musical phenomena?
Okay. Of course, you can appreciate all this stuff at a number of different levels. You don't need to have a kind of philosophical understanding of the stuff to still kind of, you know, enjoy it at all, do you? You know.
No, absolutely correct. I mean, I think musicology broadly falls into two schools. There is musicology where really you need to be a musicologist or a musician at least to understand what's been written. But there's a new school of musicology which is much broader in as much that it's designed to include the general public in the discussion. It's written in such a way so that non-musicians can interrelate with it, and that's more what I'm interested in.
My wife's second question was, that's all great, I love music as well, but if you become a musicologist and you're an expert in that field, what can you do with that knowledge?
Get a job in a university.
That's what I said.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you do get, mainly you get a job in a university, although you can get commissions to do things. I've been asked to do, you know, a whole variety. For example, I work 2-3 times a year as a forensic musicologist, which is working for major record labels on copyright litigation cases. So a record label may come to me and say, we think, you know, that this particular track has is ripping off this other track. In your opinion, how could you prove that? Or it could be the use of samples, or you know, I recently had a case in a West End show, which the incidental music in the West End show was judged to be using the individual songs of the show, which were not copyrighted by that publishing company. So I had to look into that. So but that's not going to pay the bills. So yeah, you get a job in a university. That's the answer.
What about the students who study musicology? Where do they go?
Well, of course, the students who study musicology here, it's only one element of many, many things. And I hedge it in such a way where the likelihood is they won't become musicologists. But I think as a musician, you need to have tools where you can unpick and understand what it is that make music, what makes music work. I think even if you're a composer, you know, if you want to understand what it is that makes Lady Gaga so popular, you need to have a way of understanding that and writing about it and making sense of it. Okay. So the students are very much approached from that point of view, where they can use it as part of their wider skill base.
I don't think the next in the series is going to be Lady Gaga. I can't see you going down that route yet.
No, not for me.
I don't think so.
No, thanks.
Let's go to The Dangerous Kitchen. Do you want to talk about it when we played it, or do you want to tell me something about it now, or something to watch out for? Is this the one with the dodgy language?
Later on, we're going to miss that, though. Yeah, I think it's just an incredible... I'd rather talk about it afterwards, because it has an incredible technological and also musical... technique involved in this track. So listen to it, and perhaps listeners can try and figure out what it is. It took me a while to figure it out.
The bread things are all dry and scratchy. The meat things where the cats ate through the paper. The canned things with the sharp little edges that can cut your fingers when you're not looking. The soft little things on the floor that you step on. They can all be dangerous. Sometimes the milk can hurt you. If you put it on your cereal before you smell the plastic container. And the stuff in the strainer has a mind of its own. So be very careful in the dangerous kitchen. When the nighttime has fallen and the roaches are crawling in the kitchen of danger, you can feel like a stranger. The bananas are black, they got flies in the back, and also the chicken in the dish with the foil where the cream is all clabbered. And the salad is right.
Right, we're going to just take it out there because we feel there might be an interesting moment coming along. We're just talking there. I'm terrible at remembering names, but I mean, if you think about stuff like, for example, I like Jack Kerouac and his books and Hunter S. Thompson and all this kind of stuff, and this kind of stream of consciousness ranting, let's see what's put on the table and have a go at it and see what that effect is on our mentalities and human bodies. And you'd think, listening to Frank Zappa, that, you know, he would have been indulging in all kinds of weird substances, but in fact, exactly the reverse.
Yeah, he was vehemently anti-drugs. And from what I gather, any of his band members who were caught taking drugs would be sacked. It's incredible. Yeah, it's really, you know, you look at his image, you listen to his music, especially the subject matter of his music, you know, that track, The Dangerous Kitchen. Mm. You sort of presume that it would be drug-induced, but it's not. You know, what's fascinating about that particular track, I listened to that, and you listen to it as a whole. You hear... these bizarre words, for one thing. You hear a tonality in Zappa's voice which is very much influenced by Sprechgesang, which is a form of sort of spoken singing which composers such as Berg used to use. So you hear that element. You also hear somehow this is paralleled by a guitar player. So underneath it all, note for note, this guitar is playing Zappa's vocal line identically. Now, that fascinated me. You listen to that and think, that's actually impossible. How could that happen?
Yeah.
And you dig around and that's a very young Steve Vai, the guitar player Steve Vai, when he was, I don't know, forget when that album came out. He'd be about, I think it came out in 1984, so he'd be about 23, 24. And his task there was to listen to Zappa's bizarre ramblings and transcribe it note for note and record it into the recording studio. So it sounds like the two things have gone on side by side, but in actual fact, that's the way it went around. And it's just, really, really fascinating.
Kind of strange kind of tone to the guitar playing as well, isn't it? It's almost deliberately sort of toneless in a way.
It is, it's completely toneless. Yeah,
syncopates
totally.
With the vocals somehow.
Yeah, yeah, it's completely not in key. And that's one example of Zappa's music that would never make the top 20.
Yes. I mean, he had a couple of songs which kind of crossed over a little bit more into the public kind of sphere, didn't they? I suppose he had some songs. And he was very kind of notorious, Frank Zappa, that crazy guy who writes all these songs and, you know, the kind of sexual imagery within the songs and everything else. I would guess there was quite a sort of outcry, maybe particularly in the States, at a wild guess, against this crazy guy Frank Zappa and the naughtiness he's spreading into the the teenage community.
Absolutely, hugely. I mean, in the mid 1980s, he was in opposition with an organisation called the Parents Music Resource Centre. This was an organisation that was headed up by sort of politicians' wives. I think Al Gore's wife was the sort of head poncho at that time, and the idea behind the organisation, you know, in movies where you get a classification with a movie, X or U or whatever it is, or I think now it's 15 or 18, they wanted the same sort of thing in music in America. And of course, Zappa is very much into freedom of speech. He believed very much that he should be able to say what he wanted, when he wanted. And I'm not saying one way or the other what I agree with, but Zappa really took umbrage with the Parents Music Resource Centre because they were picking on the most ridiculous people. John Denver, for example, was one of the people being targeted.
What was he doing wrong?
I forget the name of the song, but he was on the hit list, and
the Mary Whitehouse Brigade of America.
Yeah, and you know that this was a big. It was in. On CNN News at the time, and it really became a big sort of news story. And there are vestiges of it around now, where some records that you see in some CDs that you see in this country have got the stamp saying explicit lyrics and so on and so forth.
The language is pretty full on, but you know, quite often
it is. As I say, I don't know if I haven't really made my mind up what. If I agree with Zappa's position or the more conservative position, it's probably common sense somewhere in the middle, isn't it?
This might open up a big territory which I don't want to go into greatly, but it reminds me to a certain extent of Tarantino, really, in the movie world, and with the last movie that he did, sort of gratuitous use. Or is it artistic expression?
Yeah, it is. As you say, you're opening up a can of worms, and should the state have any part to play in preventing the general public from seeing that? I'm not, as I say, I don't know. I wouldn't want to pass comment one way or the other, really. But Zappa really was very much into freedom of speech, and that's why his music, wasn't radio friendly.
We're talking about Frank Zappa and The And, which is edited by Paul Carr of the University of South Wales. And maybe I'll come on to this if I can in a bit, but in the book, various academics from all around the world talk about different sort of aspects of Zappa and whatever their choice was. Mm. We're going into a song called Envelopes now, and maybe after that you could maybe refer back to, as an example of that, to the academic and what the point that they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's go with this.
Thank you.
once again, we're off on the loose goose. That's Envelopes from Frank Zappa, and Paul's point that we're talking about there, the eclecticism of sort of styles and genres, and you know, there's just no boundaries with Frank Zappa at all, are there?
No, there's not. When you asked me to choose a few pieces of music to play for this, it was initially quite daunting, but then I thought perhaps the most logical thing to do was just to choose music that represented an aspect of his sort of style, if you like, if you could say Zappa has a style, because it's so broad. Mentioning to you before off air how this piece of music, which was performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, if you look on the All Music Guide, it's actually described as rock music under a genre. It just becomes so impossible to describe Zappa, because you know, you could have a piece played by the London Symphony Orchestra 1 minute, influenced by the likes of Elliot Carter or Edgar Varese, and the next minute it could be a piece of 1950s doo-wop. It's just impossible to second guess what he's going to do. And
I know Richard Hand, because he's a colleague at the University of South Wales, and I know yourself, but you've got a whole bunch of people here with names I may mispronounce, really, but they're from all around the world. Can you just maybe talk us through a couple of people you're particularly pleased and to be involved with, and just very briefly kind of a run through who's writing them and more or less what they're writing about? Could you?
Yeah, I'll give you a quick sort of whistle-stop tour, really. This venture started off about 2 years ago, where I put a call out via sort of the academic community, just for people who were interested in Zappa and who would be interested in contributing to the edited collection. We got loads of people, many, many more than what I could have put into the book. So there was a vetting process we went through, largely related to not just the expertise of the authors, but also, you know, the subject matter they were interested in investigating. I knew what my own chapter was going to be, aside from the introduction, which sort of sets the scene. My area of interest was Zappa and technology, and Richard Hand, as you say, was sort of interested in a particular area as well. But we had people like Manuel de Fuente from Spain, who's a colleague of mine, who's actually written a book for his PhD on Zappa, in Spanish though. And I worked with Manuel to develop his chapter on the movies of Frank Zappa. He wrote 8 movies during his lifetime. In fact, he'd actually written the scores for 2 movies before he even formed the Mothers of Invention. So he'd written he'd written movie scores before that, but then he produced his own movies, which is what Manuel's area of interest was. And then we had someone like Nick Oud, who is an experienced writer and publisher himself. To get someone like Nick involved was great, because I know that he's well respected in the industry, and his chapter was entitled "Conceptual Absurdism to the Perversity of Politics." And then we had a fabulous American academic by the name of David Sanjek. Now, David was such a respected scholar, working at the University of Salford, and sadly I'm not exaggerating, 2 or 3 weeks after he handed the chapter, and he sadly died. And it was fabulous to get David's contribution, because he was an absolute expert on popular music in general, and he was in the process of writing a book on Wild Man Fisher, and his chapter was about that, and it's fabulous to have that subject area in there. And it goes on, Michel Deville, who's a friend of mine who I've known for a number of years. I've written some papers with Michel over the years, and he's actually written a book on Zappa in his own right as well. He's a well-respected sort of
Where's he from?
Zappologist. He lives in Bruges in Belgium. So it was fabulous to have him involved. I could keep going on, you know. Kevin Seal in the States. Kevin works for Pandora. I don't know if you know the organization Pandora. They're a music site.
Yeah.
And he wrote a really insightful account.
Is that still going?
Yeah, still going. Okay. He wrote a really insightful account into mainly Joe's Garage and to what makes Joe's Garage work. And then, you know, we had Claude Trastegner, who he was very much into the idea of Claude as a professor based in France, and his chapter was largely on Zappa and resistance, the ways in which he used music to resist the pressures of society and so on and so forth.
Wow.
I think the only other one that I've not mentioned, another couple actually, Martin Nakagard, who based in Denmark, and Martin wrote, I would say, the only pure musicological text on a piece of music called Brand Shoes Can't Make It, from Absolutely Free, Zappa's second album.
Right.
And that was, as I say, the only pure musicological analysis of this piece of music. Again, very insightful. And Paula Hersham, of course, who wrote the final chapter, which was on Zappa and death.
Where's she from?
She is based at the University of Brighton, and she's not in the music department. She's actually an ex-journalist, but mm-hmm. she looked at all of the papers at the time of Zappa's death and sort of wrote an account of how he was presented in the press. So yeah, all in all, you know, it was a really, really interesting sort of set of people from across the planet, really.
I'm glad you did that, because it's really interesting to hear that range of people from all around the world. What I really like about that is something I'm always banging on about to students about is creativity and imagination and the world outside the window. And you've gone with an idea, you got a fantastic response from the world outside the window. They come up with this range of completely eclectic approaches, and the whole idea of it, you know, and the end.
Mm.
You must be so really well pleased with the way it's come out. Congratulations on it. I mean, it's a fantastic, you know, thing for you to do. You must be so pleased about it, actually.
Yeah, I am very proud of it.
Sure, you wouldn't sing your own praises, but it must be great for you, you know, to do this.
Yeah, I'm very proud of the book. And I did actually miss one guy, Jeff Willis, who Jeff I'd been speaking to for a number of years. He'd been reading my blog, Paul Carr Musings, just reading it and, you know, making comments. And he came in last minute, somebody dropped out, and Jeff came in last minute and wrote a real insightful paper on Zappa and the story song, positioning Zappa as somebody who wrote story song. And then I found out that Jeff was a particularly talented guy. I didn't even know about this, but I was looking for a cover for the book, and he sent me some sketches that he'd made of Zappa. And I thought, oh yeah, I'll have one of those for the cover of the book as well. So the cover that you see on the front is in fact Jeff's sketchings. But I'd like to think that the book would play its part in the Zappa story there somewhere.
If I'd been a proper radio presenter, I would have asked you to have some sort of copy. We would have run a competition. It would have been great, but there you are.
Well, they can always contact me, you know, and I'm happy to give any information that I can. Thank you.
Let's go to Fountain of Love.
It was September, the leaves were gone. That's when our hearts knew that story untold. We were young lovers, falling near the fountain of love. Thank you.
Can't wait till the rest of the
Dickie's Such an Asshole, which was a political comment on a certain American figure. Well, Richard Nixon, actually. And before that, it was Fountain of Love. It is the Loose Goose. Fascinating programme, this one, I think, talking about this book, Frank Zappa and the And, which is out and about, but there's a launch event happening in Cardiff very shortly, and another one to come in Nottingham. Trying to remember the name of the website again. That it's if people want to go for details on the book, Paul?
It's probably best if they... you can go directly to the Ashgate website and just put Frank Zappa and the And in. But the easiest way, if anyone interested, just put Frank Zappa and the And next to my name in Google. All sorts of weird and interesting links will come up, including the official website at Ashgate, Google, and also Amazon, and also lots of posts that I made when I was actually editing the book. A lot of the chapters and a lot of my thought processes were documented in my blog.
You blog yourself,
yeah. You went along. And that will come up if you put those sort of words together in Google.
Okay. What kind of reaction have you had from to that blog when you were writing the book? Did you get any interesting reaction along the way, which maybe helped you in the final decision-making process?
Yeah, I've got to say, the Zappa community in general have been really gracious, really helpful. It would be easy to look at someone like me, you know, middle-aged sort of musicologist. And
oh, come on.
Look at me with a degree of scepticism, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've got to say, people have generally been very gracious and helpful. For example, the Zappanale Festival in Germany a few years ago, they invited me to go across to Germany to speak about some of the research things I was doing. And then they facilitated me interviewing all sorts of people who I ended up interviewing. People like Don Preston, who's the keyboard player and who was the keyboard player in Zappa's band. And
was he the keyboard player on the track you just heard?
Not that track, but he was around, for example, in 1967 in Absolutely Free. Mm. I interviewed Steve Hillage, the guitar player Steve Hillage, who was influenced by Zappa. So generally, you know, the community have engaged with me really well. There's a lot of Zappa gatekeepers like Andrew Greenaway, who I'd have to give a big thanks to as well, because whenever I've published anything, he's publicized it and made sure that people know about it. So I can only really speak highly for people.
Well, I hope you do likewise with this radio podcast.
Yeah, I will. I mean, I'll be publicizing this no end.
Good.
Well, hopefully they will.
Good. Yeah, I mean, it's just an absolutely, to me, I mean, I'm a musician and whatever, but I mean, I'm not in your league, but I've written songs, you know, since I was a teenager. And, you know, you listen to music, you enjoy the music. It's like radio in that way, really. It's just sort of something that unconsciously goes on around you and you get something out of it. But when you actually sit back from it and look at it and then analyze it, and I mean, the market and value you've got out of Frank Zappa is phenomenal.
Yeah, I say this to my students. You know, there's a huge difference between listening to music passively and listening to music actively. And quite often when you listen to music actively, you have to go against your natural tendencies. Mm. For example, there's been research out there where, for example, with myself as a guitar player, I have a tendency when I'm listening to music to naturally gravitate towards the guitar and perhaps ignore the lyrics. Likewise, if you're a keyboard player or a drummer, the likelihood is when you're listening to music, you'll naturally gravitate towards those instruments. But when you're listening to music actively, you've really got to try and pull against that and listen to music in a much more analytical way. And that's what I've tried to do with the stuff that I've been doing with Zappa and other stuff that I've been involved in, but certainly with Zappa.
Well, my territory is radio. Okay, so I encourage the students, and as much as the same way as you're saying, really, is to listen to it consciously and critically and think about sort of production values and how it is, what's actually going on, to dissect it and et cetera, et cetera. But you can go too far with that, and I don't want them to ever turn out like me, where, you know, I mean, I'm listening to something on the radio and I'm cursing and blinding and it's all going off, you know. Can it take the pleasure out of it by going too far? Is there a danger in that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the answer is yes. I think you've got to be able to move between those two paradigms of listening, you know, passive and active. There has to be a place where you just listen to music purely for pleasure and just enjoy it. It's the same as watching a movie or any other cultural artifact for that matter. But equally so, I think if you're serious about your subject matter, there has to be some time when you listen to the music seriously. But if you only did that, I think it would be a pretty sad state of affairs. I think there's a place for both.
Yeah. And I mean, when hopefully, I would hope that, you know, students would listen to this. And because it's, you know, what I like about the Loose Goose is that it just gives this bit. We're in the University of South Wales. We could be in any university, but happen to be in the University of South Wales. Here we are in Cardiff. But the building's full of these interesting, fascinating characters. You know, they get wheeled in for lectures. They do their bit. They disappear. But when you actually drag them out and get into their minds, particularly actually with music, often, there's so many great stories to tell. And I would hope that that would have an impact on and resonate with students. You know, what a fantastic idea. I could do X, Y, and Z. I would hope that would happen.
Yes, I'd like to think so. You're absolutely right. I think because of the nature of what we do, you know, we're wheeled in for lectures. We then wheel ourselves out and, you know, we obviously do tutorials with students and so on and so forth. But quite often you haven't got the time to talk about your full background. I mean, I've been a professional musician. I've been engaged with professional music making now for over 30 years. And, you know, I don't think I've ever talked about my professional career or very rarely talked about my professional music-making career. It was quite a while ago now. You know, when I first started teaching in universities, some of the students, it was bizarre, they were actually playing some of the tracks that I'd played on. Now, it's 20 years later and, you know, that music was written quite a while ago. But, yeah, it's only through really discussions like this that you begin, oh yeah, I was a professional musician at one point, and you know, and it's good for the students to know that, really.
Well, Paul, thanks very much for your time. Let's hope you come back and do another Goose sometime. Good luck with the book, and I hope you've enjoyed it, and you know, thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve, really enjoyed it.
We're going to end with Blessed Relief. Do you want to give this a little snap summary or just let it play and speak for itself?
No, I will say something at the start of this. I included this one for two reasons. Firstly, it was one of the first tracks I ever heard with Zappa. So it's got a sentimental sort of nostalgia attached to it.
Right.
Secondly, as we've discussed through this program, Zappa is associated with so many styles of music. Not many people associate Zappa with jazz, and he had this famous quote in his autobiography where he said, jazz isn't dead, it only smells funny. It's based on Nietzsche. It's a play on words from Nietzsche's famous comment that God's dead. But in actual fact, Zappa was involved in some pioneering jazz albums in the early 70s. Hot Rats being one of them, and you know, I really think he's massively underrepresented in his impact on the fusion of jazz and rock, possibly because of comments like what I've just said, where he tended to underplay it. But this is a great example of Zappa, you know, really interfacing with both jazz and rock in a really profound way that was years ahead of its time.